podcast brought to you by the Triad Network. This podcast is designed to share trending topics occurring within the world and our communities and bring them a behavioral and mental health perspective.
Welcome to Behavior Health Today, a Triad production. I'm Dr. Graham Taylor. Psychotherapy is a life-changing process for those who enter into doing their own work with a trained therapist. Standard therapy, utilizing best practice approaches, works to help folks understand how one's upbringing and early relational interactions contribute to current day life, and how distorted beliefs and thinking patterns can negatively impact one's sense of self and unintentionally foreclose on healthy and corrective interactions in their adult lives. As therapists, we help our patients recognize core vulnerabilities, assist with mourning and grieving painful experiences and losses, create a truth-based sense of themselves, develop effective coping strategies, build corrective emotional relationships, and help them learn ways to carry their pain more manageably and in such a way that it doesn't interfere with their lives in such a costly and troubling manner. But what about those patients that present with complex or treatment-resistant trauma? In these cases, standard therapeutic approaches, as effective as they can be, can't cross over into the realm where trauma is held. The result can be someone being left with their trauma and the torment and challenge of learning to live with the anguish from their experiences. But what if there was a way to access this healing place that is inherently and intelligently designed in each one of us that, once accessed, can free us from our experienced suffering? With me today to address a pathway and process to access this available healing potential is Saj Razvi. Saj is a licensed counselor and director of education at the Psychedelic Somatic Institute, also referred to as PSI. Saj was a clinical researcher in a MAPS phase 2 trial of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for post-traumatic stress disorder. He has taught trauma studies at the University of Denver and is a nationally sought-after topic expert for psychedelic somatic interaction psychotherapy, also referred to as PSIP. His primary focus is on the wide-scale adoption and accessibility of psychedelic therapy through training therapists to work with cannabis and ketamine-assisted therapy in private practice settings. We apologize for the audio quality, but I know that the content in this episode will be very valuable to you. Saj, welcome to our show.
Hi, Graham. Thank you for having me.
I'm so pleased to be here with you today, and I'm excited about our show, as I mentioned earlier. You know, I know there are some scientific findings that you are both excited about and eager to let us know regarding the capacity for psychedelic substances to provide a powerful experience that can be turned into significant therapeutic benefits. Start us out with an understanding of what is psychedelic therapy.
Psychedelic therapy has a long history, and if you want to read about it, Michael Pollan's latest book sort of is a good summary of it. It's called How to Change Your Mind. Basically, I would say psychedelic therapy is what we do when the client's mind enters an altered state of consciousness, usually on a particular substance like MDMA, like psilocybin, and they enter a non-ordinary state of consciousness. And this is something like a dream state that people can enter, and it gives us a lot more access to their unconscious mind, their unconscious programming, you know, what I would call the world of non-declarative memory, sort of memory that, you know, we can't put words to, but is highly experiential.
I really want to come back to that consciousness piece, because that's what you're really directing us towards. And I think maybe what I mentioned earlier is that we have these standard practices, these best practice approaches that can be so efficacious in the treatment of a number of psychological issues that we know. But you're saying trauma is distinct and unique. Why don't these standard therapies have the same effect, a positive effect, as maybe what you're talking about, the psychedelics? In other words, why does therapy need to be different as we talk about trauma?
Yeah. Well, we have the numbers for traditional therapy. We have the numbers for CBT. And in best case laboratory situations, CBT is effective anywhere from, you know, 17 to 24% of the time. So there's a whole lot of people out there that, you know, we do need better interventions for. And the reason why, I think there probably are a few reasons. One of the big ones is, I would say, dissociation. So we know that one of the key things that happens in trauma and PTSD is that the mind enters a very different state when a certain level of threat is encountered, and that state is a highly dissociative state. what we know that happens neurologically, biologically at that time is that the nervous system is able to release these numbing opioid substances. And I don't mean people would take opioids. I mean, we have endogenous opioids that get released when a high level of threat shows up. And so basically our cognitive capacities, our insight capacities are very limited when they encounter somebody in a highly dissociative state. So the interesting thing about that, Graham, is I think that people can be operating in a state of dissociation and not know it, right? Yes. So for example, people can live an entire childhood if their childhood had abandonment in it or neglect or threat or abuse in it. You know, I'll almost guarantee you that this person has some core level of dissociation that their system is operating inside of. And, you know, they can develop a cognitive capacity that's functional in the world on top of that. But, you know, there's sort of an emptiness, a blankness that's underneath it all that we find very difficult to access.
When you talk about what's underneath it all, you're kind of shifting us into the role of our consciousness. Talk to me about what we know about our consciousness and its impact on complex and treatment-resistant trauma that informs us, like you're saying, that we need to utilize a different therapeutic approach than those typically used for most psychological issues. In other words, we need something different to access the trauma that is underneath, primary and secondary consciousness. That's what's at play here.
Yeah. So primary and secondary consciousness is an idea most recently supported by Robin Carhart-Harris, who's a neuroscientist. He's well known in the psychedelic research field. He's at Imperial College in London. And it's interesting, he's psychodynamically oriented and he's a neuroscientist. And so basically he's suggesting that, you know, there's really good evidence to say that the human mind has two modes that we can operate inside of. The mode that we're most familiar with, that we're talking in right now, is what's known as secondary consciousness. It's your rational mind. It's capable of abstract reasoning, symbolic thought. You know, it's how we operate normally. And
it tends to be kind of that more verbal, kind of rational part of our mind, isn't it? That kind of organizes and structures those things that allow us to be successful.
Yeah, absolutely. It's verbal,
cognitive, goal-oriented, the abstract piece of it, self-reflection. Yeah.
Exactly. Self-reflection, self-awareness, goal orientation. Yeah. These are all features of secondary consciousness. And the thing about it is that, you know, this is a evolutionary development. It's a survival strategy.
We need the secondary consciousness.
Yeah. We need it. It's very successful, more than flight or armoring or other types of advantages nature could have given us. You know, our secondary consciousness helps us predict what's going to happen in our environment. And it's obsessed with detailing reality in a very objective way. And so it gives us sort of a filtered version of reality. It basically takes out all the noise and all the experiences that are actually going on in reality and gives us a very cleaned up signal, as it were.
That's a great description.
Yeah. So it is rational, it's linear, and ultimately it helps us predict and manipulate reality, manipulate our environment. And hence we have, you know, all of modern civilization that really is due to secondary consciousness. It's kind of an amazing development for us. However, the secondary form of consciousness that human beings are capable of, and this is the one we lose track of, is what's known as primary consciousness. It's much more animalistic in nature. It's visceral. It's an embodied form of awareness. It's concerned with concrete sensory information. It's concerned with emotions and images. So animals operate in primary consciousness. Children operate in primary consciousness. So if you can try to imagine back to what the world felt like for you when you were a child, that's primary consciousness, right? So there's magical thinking. There's a lot of wonder and awe and excitement at the world. The world is a very fresh place for children. And so there's real benefits to having secondary consciousness, but there's a big price to pay for also having secondary consciousness, which is access to that wonderment, which is access to that primary conscious state.
That primary conscious piece as you're talking about, that's that unconstrained, kind of that visceral body sensation, kind of emotional imagery creating part of ourselves that I love what you're wording earlier. The secondary consciousness is so necessary, but it kind of cleans up and filters things in such a way that it allows us to function in life, but it also prevents access to that primary conscious, which may be a little more chaotic,
yeah,
and might be a little more wild down there, but you're saying this is where we can access in a therapeutic way now to manage trauma that we know. Van der Kolk talks about how our traumatic memories are imprinted in our sensory and emotional modes that remain frozen and stable and unaltered by other life events. So even corrective emotional experiences are nice, but it doesn't alter that trauma that gets held down there. And Kiesling talks about how there's an isolated neural network trauma base of where our trauma lives, that even though we have this great therapy, more cognitive in nature, even psychodynamic in nature, with corrective experiences occurring, it doesn't get down to that level, does it?
Yeah, I would say so. Again, I mean, I think the more talk therapy is a secondary consciousness process. Insight is a secondary consciousness process, as is reality testing and cognitive restructuring, right? So all of these things are designed to find stability, to find symptom management through moving a client's consciousness towards secondary consciousness and the stability that we find there. And we tend to do that because primary consciousness is a wild place. So again, if you can imagine somebody having a nightmare and you're stepping into the nightmare with that person. And dreams, nightmares are not rational. They're not linear. There's no reality testing that you can do in those places because there's no reality happening there, right? So, but what you're experiencing is the reality that is held in the client's consciousness. Even if it was coming from complete distortion of events or something like that, we're interested in the truth as it is held in the client's system, because that's where their symptoms are coming from. So the first thing that we encounter when we enter primary consciousness, well, it's reactivity, it's instability, it's distortions, right? All of these things are there, along with profound resources, along with profound homeostatic corrective mechanisms. So in other words, in a society and a culture that's completely geared towards secondary consciousness, we profoundly distrust what's happening in primary consciousness.
Really good.
We'll be right back after word from our sponsor.
Most of us spend more time at work than anywhere else doing anything else. So why not spend that time in a job you love? Introducing Triad's Jobs Marketplace, the only job site dedicated specifically to behavioral and mental health professionals. Featuring more than 1,000 open jobs from dozens of behavioral and mental health employers, and searchable by location, professional field, employment type, specialization, and more. Jobs Marketplace helps you find your next career opportunity. Full-time, part-time, or gig time, make the most of your time. To access Jobs Marketplace, register for your free professional account at hellotriad.com/BHT. That's hellotriad.com/BHT. And then click to Jobs Marketplace. If you're already a member of the Triad community, visit app.hellotriad.com/jobs. That's app.hellotriad.com/jobs. Visit us today and take your next career step tomorrow.
Yeah, so you're saying there are these biological components in our primary consciousness that are able to process anxiety, depression, PTSD, emotions, and traumatic memory far more effectively than the more verbal, like you're saying, abstract cognitive processes of the secondary consciousness. And it's this focus on these features of one's primary consciousness that the PSIP begins to target during that psychedelic state.
Yeah, exactly. So in other words, when somebody enters a psychedelic state, again, their brain is entering primary consciousness. So, and most of our therapeutic interventions are designed to have people enter secondary consciousness. So that seems to me to be somewhat counterproductive. and so the therapy model that we designed, PSIP, is saying, no, let's let go of secondary consciousness for the time being, and let's develop these interventions that really support the healing mechanisms that are already inside of primary consciousness. So we really do target those things like the autonomic nervous system has a lot of healing capacities that we encounter. Working with the transference capacity that is held, the transference that's part of a traumatic memory is another thing that we encounter in primary consciousness. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Saj, I want to come back. Thanks for kind of teeing that up and flagging that for us. I want to come back and talk about how you say there's this beautiful synergistic potentiation possible between our primary consciousness and our autonomic nervous system, and how that can be so facilitative, as well as a transferential role of the therapist in this process as well. Let me flag that and come back to that. What I really want to highlight here that I think is one of the most important pieces for our listeners is to understand. And I guess what it for me is, it's in what I'm struck by, and I've actually always been awed by, is that our bodies want to heal. That's what you're saying. It has this wiser, intelligent dimension that has the potential, when accessed, to help heal in ways that are at a level we can't access with our conscious intent. But there's a curious thing here, and it's what I hear you pointing out to us. And this is a part I really hope folks can understand here. While it's the suppression of that more chaotic order of the primary conscious, kind of the wild, wild west down there, whilst the suppression of that and the management of that, that makes us human and allows our ability to predict and understand things and to manipulate the world around us, it's this very survival mechanism, this secondary consciousness, our defense mechanisms, our developed coping strategies, all in the service to protect us from pain. But they're actually inhibiting access to the level and depth available to us that can help us self-correct and heal trauma.
Yeah, that's a huge aspect of what's going on here. So Robin Carhart-Harris, again, neuroscientist, Imperial College, basically is suggesting that really the key thing that separates us from other animals is this capacity for our default mode network, our secondary consciousness, to suppress the functioning of primary consciousness. That's the whole ball game. That's what separates us from animals. And again, there's huge benefit to that and a huge, huge downside to that. So let's go into this a little bit, that I think people are not surprised when we say that biologically we have homeostatic mechanisms that keep us in well-being, right? So for example, if you overheat, your body starts sweating to cool you down, right? If you eat too much sugar, your body releases insulin to rebalance your blood chemistry. So basically there are hundreds and hundreds of these physiological homeostatic features that our bodies are doing all the time without us paying attention to them or being aware of it at all, you know, to keep us healthy. The thing is that our bodies do the same thing with mental health symptoms. And that, I think, is what is surprising to most people, that we have homeostasis when it comes to mental health, and we just don't trust it, right? So we think that to heal from mental health disorders or traumatic experiences, we have to go into secondary consciousness and figure it out and understand everything and find the source of things, when in fact, our biology has evolved to actually heal from things like highly stressful events and traumatic events.
Yeah, I think that's it right there. There's a homeostatic process that takes place in every aspect of our lives, including the mental health area. However, and I love the way you're putting this, insight alone is not enough. Being able to connect the dots is not enough to resolve or bring to resolution some of the trauma that can be most painful. At its best, I find that we help people understand their areas of vulnerability. Let's say like a pothole. This is your area of vulnerability. Here's where you struggle. And so we teach them how to recognize what it is, how not to fall into it so frequently, or when they do, not to go down so deep. We have coping strategies and techniques to kind of manage getting out of that place. And we patch them up and help them learn how to patch themselves up more quickly. All good. But their life is left with being only as good until the next time they get triggered, or only as good as they've learned how to manage their trauma. Mm-hmm. Wow. But we can go deeper. And that's what you're talking about here. What if we go down past that secondary insight-based, cognitive-oriented focus and down to a level where we can bring together a resolution with the body's inherent healing processes that we can access now with the psychedelic substances?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're describing is the difference. You're giving a lot more eloquence to the difference between symptom management techniques that we really need sometimes. And it's like, okay, I broke my leg and here's a good crutch. And, you know, I'm really good on this crutch and I've been working with it for years and years, as opposed to, you know, what does the body actually need to heal the bone, right? That kind of thing. So yeah, I think we're talking about a completely different endeavor here with psychedelic therapy.
Mm-hmm. So let's shift a little bit. Let's talk about what are some of the meds that are being used, substances that are being used, and how are they going to be facilitative and kind of healing the bone? What are the medications and what do they do to our systems, do you find?
Yeah. So let's name the substances that are being used right now and are coming down the pipe, right? So basically there's MDMA. That's the one that a lot of people know about because it's in the end phases of the FDA approval process. It will, I think there's no doubt at this point that it's going to be legalized as an FDA approved medication for the treatment of PTSD.
Okay.
There is psilocybin that is also been given the breakthrough therapy status by the FDA. And it's a little controversial because it's being sort of moved through that approval process by a for-profit pharmaceutical company called Compass Pathways. And while there's benefit and wonderful that, you know, psychedelics are being acknowledged by the medical community, this is a very for-profit venture and they're looking to put a patent on something that really should be available to all of us. It's mushrooms, right? Psilocybin is the active psychedelic compound in mushrooms. And parallel to that movement with psilocybin through the FDA approval process, we also have states like Oregon. There are many places that are passing decriminalization efforts, but Oregon is unique in that it's passing a full legalization effort of psilocybin to be used therapeutically. So while you know, you've got this FDA pathway going on. There's a movement by states to pass psilocybin legalization laws. And I think it's going to look very much like what cannabis looked like, okay. Right? So there are those two. There's ketamine, which is already a FDA-approved medication. It's a dissociative anesthetic drug that's been researched very well from the 1970s by the anesthesiology community. But used in lower doses, people stay awake and they have a very solid psychedelic response to ketamine. Very frequently, people are using ketamine. Doctors are using ketamine in these infusion clinics that don't have any therapy component to them. People just go to a clinic, they get an IV and they sit in a darkened room for 40 minutes. And they have a biochemical response of an antidepressant response that gets created by the ketamine. But we find that if you take the same substance and you can get a prescription, sometimes if your doctor allows that to be used in therapy, you can do psychotherapy with ketamine. And it, again, very solid psychedelic response. I would say it looks very much like psilocybin in many ways. And then something that we have been really looking into is the psychedelic response that cannabis is capable of. And that is a surprise. That was a surprise to us. That's a surprise to most people who know cannabis because it's so widely available as a recreational drug. You know, it's a thing that people tried in high school and, you know, how could it have a psychedelic response? How could it be therapeutically useful? Most mental health professionals are very skeptical about cannabis because many people do use it to check out from their lives. Many people do use it as, you know, the same way that you could use alcohol. So it like any substance, it can be used poorly for those reasons, or it could be used really well. And we find that cannabis, perhaps more so than any other medicine, when it's used in a very different context, when it's used in a psychotherapy setting that's designed to access its psychedelic potential, it becomes, a very solid psychedelic. It becomes a great excavating tool to get at what's going on underneath.
I love the piece that you're highlighting right now. It's not just putting people into a trip and letting them go and then hoping to see what happens. We'll be talking in a few minutes about the role of the therapist in the process that allows the real work to be done and facilitated in that time. But what you're saying about the psychedelic substances is that they aren't actually creating anything new per mm-hmm. se in one mm-hmm. system, but they're providing a deeper access to really our implicit kind of embedded self in that primary conscious where we get to go, where there's that healing possible. And that's where all of one's experiences truly get carried that have gone into creating a sense of who they are and how their lives have been experienced to date.
Yeah. You're programming the core of who you are is in primary consciousness. So I think the best image to use for that is essentially Freud's topographical map of the psyche, which is, you know, if you think of an iceberg, 10% of it is visible to us. That would be equivalent to secondary consciousness. It's your rational mind. And then 90% of the iceberg is under the surface of the water. It's invisible to you, but that's really what's running the show. And psychedelics give access to what's under the surface of the water. Now, the interesting thing about the different medicines that are out there is, in a way, they all do the same thing. Through different pathways, they all take us to primary consciousness. So regardless of what you're using, the experience can be somewhat similar. Now, having said that, there are differences as well. There are different flavors that these medicines provide. So, for example, many people in the psychedelic medicine communities, you know, people who have used ayahuasca or something like that, the classic tryptamines are typically what we would call transpersonal medicines, meaning that they take you to God, right? They take you to unity consciousness. They take you to the divine. They really cause people to transcend their own egos and see a much bigger reality out there. It's extraordinary to see that. And it can be incredibly healing to see that. Now, something like MDMA, for example, is not a transpersonal medicine. And I think that's to its benefit, right? So both MDMA and cannabis, I would say, are very body-oriented medicines. They put people deeply in touch with what is happening somatically for them. And when you're talking about trauma, when you're talking about developmental trauma, like attachment disorders, things that happened in your family of origin that really created distress for you, you know, I think things like MDMA and cannabis are really excellent for that, because they have you focus on and make contact with your ego and the events that created sort of this wounded place, as opposed to transcending something that's very painful.
So you're able to make a clear determination or an appropriate selection of the medication, knowing what the patient's presenting issues are and what they need to be doing, something along the lines of, we might choose MDMA or cannabis if there's a somatic or attachment issue and they need to kind of stay in their body to work through that. You get to be specific in your selection of the drug.
Yeah, I think we will get to a point in the future where we'll have enough selection that we can do that. I mean, the FDA is so careful about its release, and they're going to monitor it and regulate it very, very heavily. So in other words, there's going to be a very elaborate framework and protocol for people entering and doing MDMA work. I think for some things like ketamine, which are already widely available, and cannabis, which is even more widely available, and not even, you don't need a doctor's note to work with that. Then with those medicines, you can choose. And certainly when psilocybin becomes available in Oregon and around the country, then I think between those three medicines, you can easily choose. I think if you're going to head into working with MDMA, it's going to be a little more prescribed, right? Okay. It's going to, yeah.
You're talking about somatic attachment issues, and yeah. I'm curious as to who is a good candidate for this therapy and who are some of the folks that you're seeing in your treatment?
You know, I would say right now, the people coming in for psychedelic therapy are coming in because they've gone through years and years of traditional therapy. They've gone down the medication psychiatric route, and things haven't worked out well for them. And so really, they're people who are using psychedelic medicine as a last line of treatment. So in other words, it's people that have the much more severe cases. It's people that have a lot of, you know, chronic early childhood wounding that's going on, that's being hidden and protected by dissociation. So it's the people that traditional therapy and psychiatric interventions can't really help. And so that population that's who we're seeing more of right now. But I think as time goes on and this just kind of enters into the fabric of our culture, you're going to have people that don't have that level of trauma or abuse in their childhood, but have, you know, more traditional neurotic symptoms. And those people will still step in and say, well, yeah, I'm going to deal with this working with psychedelics. Because even though psychedelics, I think their true brilliance, their true gift is going to primary consciousness, going to the core, completely invisible core of what's going on, the core that's hidden in dissociation, I think we can move even more quickly and resolve things even more faster when the wounds aren't that profound.
Yeah, you talk about this potentiating kind of accelerant opportunity that the psychedelics provide.
Folks, pardon the interruption, but we'll conclude this discussion in our next episode. I want to thank my guest, Saj Razvi. For more information about Psychedelic Somatic Institute, please visit psychedelicsomatic.org. You can also learn more about psychedelic therapy and their work by downloading the PSIP white paper located at the bottom of their homepage. You can also view videos of psychedelic therapy in process by going to psychedelicsomatic.org/resources. And lastly, we want to thank you, our listeners, for tuning in, and we'll look forward to having you join us next time on Behavior Health Today.
We appreciate all the support from our community, and if you like our show, one of the best ways you can support it is by giving us a 5-star rating and leaving a review. Behavioral Health Today is a podcast part of the Tribe Network, all rights reserved.